try to launch into my whole spiel, and it usually takes a long time. I have friends that have known me since I was 12 years old, and I'm still arguing with them about trying to establish that this is a loss, and they don't understand it to be a loss. It's isolating. It's extremely isolating. Because every time you try to open up about your dad, people don't, they don't get it at all.
Well, thank you so much for all of you for joining us. Alana Stewart, you just heard her. She joins us from NPR New York. We were also joined by Elizabeth Marquardt. She joined us from Evanston, Illinois. She's the author of the study, My Daddy's Name is Donor. Also with us, Wendy Kramer. She joins us from member station KGNU in Boulder. She's currently working on what will be the largest study on sperm donors and sperm donor offspring to date. And she's the founder of DonorSiblingRegistry.com. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much.
Finally, a word about former JetBlue flight attendant slash folk hero Stephen Slater. He of the dramatic exit from his aircraft and apparently his job last week. Let me just say up front, I have very little sympathy for this man. So what if he was having a bad day and he says some passenger was rude to him, even abusive to him? That does not, to my way of thinking, justify cursing at a whole plane load full of people, most of whom were probably perfectly nice or just as cranky and tired as he was. In my mind, his conduct constitutes an abuse of power. And while I'm very sure he did not see himself as powerful in that situation, he was, because he was the one wearing the uniform and acting on behalf of the corporation that had hired him and gave him specific duties and the authority to carry them out. And that means he had all kinds of ways to address his situation short of cursing out people who'd paid a tidy sum for the purpose of being so treated. But having said that, I still find myself wondering why he had to be handcuffed and paraded before the television cameras, and increasingly I wonder if this is not an abuse of power of its own, an increasingly common practice imposed on people for just about anything, and so common, in fact, we barely notice it anymore. Now, of course, at the simplest level, I know why the authorities do it. This is a way of law enforcement reinforcing its authority and letting the public know they are on the job. It's probably a response to the clamor of the news media for more and more access. And on a visceral level, one can see why this satisfies a lot of societal urges. When somebody's done something horrible, we have a desire to know that the good guys, our guys, are in control. And if that means parading someone in handcuffs, so be it. Certainly, it's reassuring to see someone like John Allen Muhammad, the sniper who terrified the D.C. area a decade ago, under control, or someone like Elias Abuelazam, who's accused of stabbing at least 18 people for no apparent reason, five of whom died, or even the Enron crowd who cost so many people their hard-earned savings. I can see how seeing those people in handcuffs brings a sigh of relief. The question I have is, should it? Can I just tell you, it strikes me that this ever more common ritual of humiliation seems incompatible with a system of laws of which we are justifiably proud, and at the core of that system is the principle that people are innocent until they're proven guilty in a court of law, as judged by a jury of their peers. Needless to say, the class and race-driven aspects of this are hard to ignore. When someone with money is required to face the authorities, the first thing a defense lawyer worth his retainer is likely to do is try to arrange a dignified surrender so as not to implant in the minds of potential jurors someone in disarray, shuffling awkwardly forward, which is, it seems to me, although I do not know from personal experience, the only way I imagine you can walk in handcuffs and possibly leg irons. In recent years, all kinds of people from all kinds of political perspectives have raised their voices to try to confront what seem to be deeply ingrained racial biases in law enforcement. The fact that blacks and Latinos are more likely to be searched after routine traffic stops. The fact that black and Latino youth are more likely to be arrested and incarcerated for the kinds of offenses that earn their white peers counseling or no penalty at all. The fact that blacks who murder whites are far more likely to be executed than the other way around. But as to the perp walk, it seems that the authorities are responding to the...
I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
There's nothing like a summer tomato, red and plump and plucked right off the vine, so the juices inside are still slightly warm from the sun. Good stuff. But by the second week of August, even the most ardent tomato aficionados find that they have too much of a good thing if they're growing tomatoes in the backyard or if they can't resist the urge to fill up their baskets when they head to the local farmer's market. So today, we're going to serve up a little advice on what to do with the tower of summer tomatoes so many of us have stacked on kitchen counters or ripening on our windowsills. For help, we've turned to a couple of guys named Frank. Frank Falsinelli and Frank Castronovo own a popular Brooklyn restaurant called Frankie Spuntino, Along with Peter Meehan, they've just published a new cookbook called The Frankie Spuntino Kitchen Companion and Cooking Manual. Hello, Frank. Hello, Frank. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
I hope this will be a frank conversation.
We'll be frank as we can.
Both of you have worked in all kinds of restaurants. You've worked in sort of high-end, top-dollar, white tablecloth restaurants, the kind of restaurants where people go to celebrate big events and spend a lot of money in doing so. What are you trying to do with this restaurant, with Frankie Spuntino, and with the book?
We wanted to share what we had been brought up with, which is after seeing the best of the best around the world, we realized that what we had growing up, you know, simple Southern Italian, even peasant food, was amazing, and it had everything. The nutrition, the flavor, the freshness, the simplicity, the love, it was all in there. And we took the lessons that we learned and the experience that we had, and we applied it to grandma's food.
And you say grandma never broke a sweat, neither should you.
Yeah, and if you could imagine, you know, doing that with the restaurant, the idea with the book was really to have a guide for people to get that grandma flavor in their home, you know, any time for their family or their friends or their loved ones. And to be able to, you know, have those go-to recipes that really work. You know, if I want to make the bruschetta or the tomato sauce, if I want to live like an Italian, or if I want to redux my Italian recipes, and then not to be like the gimmicky Italian red sauce thing, like, hey, I'm going to cook some Italian today. You know, these are really serious recipes that work. You know, we serve thousands of people a week that love the food, that come back for it. And from the book, you can recreate it at home, and you can realize how good it is and how inexpensive it is at home.
So, Frank Falsinelli, is this a season of opportunity or a season of responsibility for you when you've got all these tomatoes?
It's the opportunity. You really want to just eat it all. It's like picking the money tree. You want to eat as much tomatoes, but you also realize that you can't eat them all. So you need to start canning them or jarring them, as we do in our case. Frank Castronova was big on, you know, towards the end of the summer, leading the brigade and getting everybody psyched up to work with hot water and jars for a couple of days, get them put up for the winter.
Yeah, they taste good all year long. It's like a little reminder of what that day was like in August and when it was hot and how beautiful it was.
So let me ask you what people who have all these tomatoes could do if they want to prepare dishes for the here and now. And maybe we could go through a day. Let's start with tomatoes for breakfast. Frank Falsinelli, what should we do if we want to tick through some of those tomatoes at the breakfast table?
I like actually putting sugar and pepper on tomatoes if I'm going to eat them before 10 o'clock. So I'll sprinkle it with a little bit of sugar, a little bit of honey, a little drizzle, and then a crack of pepper or some crushed red pepper. So it doesn't feel like you're eating something that's
savory
in the wrong time period, like what happens when you put pineapple and pepper or you put salt on watermelon. You know, you get a juxtaposition in your mind of eating something that isn't normally eaten as a savory or a sweet product.
Okay, Frank Castronova, you've got lunch. What are we serving up?
Well, that's the perfect time for the tomato and avocado salad, which Frank coined the phrase gazpacho in the mouth. It's fresh tomatoes from the garden, juicy, delicious, and sweet. Avocados, onions, salt and pepper, olive oil. There you have it.
And easy.
Yeah, we're all about easy. We're all about practical, utilitarian recipes that everybody can make. You don't need to be a four-star chef.
Yeah, if you're driving home from work right now, you could be listening to this. Think about the tomatoes, think about the onion, think about the avocado. Stop and pick it up. Go into the garden, grab the olive oil, and in 10 minutes, you and your family or your girlfriend or your wife or whatever are eating a delicious something.
So let's move on to dinner. And I guess in our ping pong tomato game, Frank Falsinelli, we're back to you.
We're serving the crab pasta. And, it's an anticipated favorite of Frank and myself and our partners, Tony and Travis and the guys. We love when the fresh crabs, the young crabs come in the beginning of August. It's very Neapolitan that, you know, you're taking those crabs and you're just sweating it in a little bit of olive oil. You're adding the tomatoes on top. You're cooking maybe for 25, 30 minutes for a quick infusion of that delicious ocean flavor. And then you're taking the crabs out and picking the meat and cooking a fresh pound of pasta. We cook fresh pasta at the restaurant, but you can easily make it with dry pasta al dente, and then you mix it with the sauce and fresh olive oil and salt and pepper, and you're in heaven.
So how are you cooking the crab? Are you actually cooking it in the sauce, or do you cook the crab ahead of time?
We're cooking in the sauce, and as Frank always says, we cook everything in tomato sauce, and we use it in this sense as an infusion technique, as opposed to the brujol, when we're cooking the brujol in there, which is a rolled up piece of pork, basically, we slow braise it for its tenderizing effect, where you wind up with a delicious pork-infused gravy.
Yeah.
You wind up with a delicious crab-infused sauce.
Yeah, the beauty of crab or any fish is that it infuses its full potential in a short period of time, whereas a meat will take a long time to really get the flavors in there. The crab is in season at the same time as the tomato, so it's natural for them to be together.
Mm. Now, Frank Castronova, you get the bonus round. Can we figure out how to serve tomatoes in a dessert?
Well, we can, actually. There's an amazing ice cream, or actually not an ice, it's a granité.
Delicious.
It's so delicious. You're basically just pureeing the tomato with water and adding some sugar, and then you're freezing that, and you're scraping it over a piece of bread. It's almost like the AM dish, but it's frozen and sweet.
Mm. Frank Falsinelli and Frank Castronovo, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Frank Falsinelli and Frank Castronovo are the authors of a new cookbook called The Frankie Spuntino Kitchen Companion and Cooking Manual. If you'd like to try any of the dishes they just talked about, grab your tomatoes and head to our website. You'll find recipes for tomato granite, tomato avocado salad, and spaghetti with crab. That's at npr.org.
Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a big homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll I be without home?
This is NPR.
Let's look a little more closely now at what's happening in the housing market. Suppose you are lucky enough to get a loan from a bank and you get a good deal on your new house. There are still closing costs on top of the sale price, inspection fees, title costs, dozens of other items which can add thousands of dollars to the price of a house or a condo. A new survey by Bankrate.com says those costs are rising fast. Here's NPR's Jim Zaroli.
The survey says the average closing costs for a mortgage, costs like title insurance and building inspection fees, have risen from about $2,700 to more than $3,700 over the past year. New York, Texas, and California have the highest fees, and Arkansas the lowest. Bankrate's Holden Lewis says the increase is partly caused by new regulations imposed on lenders by the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Lenders hire someone to check to make sure that you have a job. Lenders have to conduct at least two credit checks nowadays, once when you apply and right before closing. All of these things are applying basically to every new loan, and so their costs have gone up.
Lewis says the jump in closing costs may not be as big as the survey suggests. In the past, lenders often lowballed estimated costs before the closing date, but new regulations put in place by the Bush administration required lenders to give a more accurate estimate, and that's reflected in the survey. But Lewis says there is no question that actual costs have gone up as well. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Last week, Farhad Manju caused an uproar when he wrote a piece for Slate.com called How Black People Use Twitter. We asked NPR's Sam Sanders to find out why the article made so many people so mad.
Whenever you have a headline that starts with the three words how, black, and people, someone's going to get upset. Not to mention the addition of a controversial photo. In this case, the little blue Twitter bird, colored brown, holding a smartphone, wearing an oversized baseball cap. But Slate's Farhad Manju said he knew what he was getting into when he wrote How Black People Use Twitter.
I was bound to offend people with this article, but I thought that it was kind of worth a risk to ask and perhaps answer some interesting questions.
His question was why so many popular topics on Twitter, called hashtags, seem to come from blacks, specifically black youth. Manju says he made that observation by checking out their Twitter profile photos.
Young black people are not a group of people that I see every day. I don't have any teenage black friends. And the fact that they were part of this conversation just a click away from me was something that I was very interested in. I was seeing trending topics every day that were dominated by black people.
Trending topics like words that lead to trouble, or if Santa was black, or ghetto baby names. Manju says black teens follow more people, retweet more often, and reply to posts more frequently on Twitter, causing certain topics to rise in popularity that have nothing to do with breaking news or celebrities like Justin Bieber. That premise might seem pretty innocuous, but once it hit the web, there was a backlash.
Is this a reasonable way to talk about people who are still right there in the room?
That's Baratunde Thurston, a popular blogger and comedian featured in Manju's piece.
If you look at the network of 40-year-old white male technologists, you will see that they talk to each other a lot as well, and they're retweeting each other and replying to each other, but it doesn't stand out because that is considered mainstream.
Danielle Belton of BlackSnob.com wrote a blog post criticizing the article. She said that Manju was making something out of nothing.
It's like a black person on a bike. I've never seen that. Black people ride bikes? There's a black guy on a skateboard. Black people ride skateboards? And it becomes like a thing. Like, no, no, no. They're on a bike and a skateboard the same reason why anybody would be on a bike and a skateboard. There's like no special racialized way of skateboarding or riding a bike. And that's the same kind of way it is with Twitter.
But Slate's Farhad Manju says that on Twitter, black people do behave differently.
The reason that the article's about black people is because these participants in these hashtags are using the service in a unique way. And I think that one of the reasons why I wasn't interested in how white people use Twitter is because I haven't seen groups of white people use it in this very interesting way.
Which takes us back to that Slate image of a Twitter bird with brown skin and an oversized baseball cap. The image used to further illustrate these unique black tweeters. So forget about the question of whether the premise of the article was right or wrong. That black Twitter bird went viral. BlackSnob.com's Danielle Belton.
Now, the photo, oh my God, the photo. Like, the photo was this weird combination of both cute and offensive.
Alicia Nasruddin of the blog Instant Vintage was the first to parody the black Twitter bird. She photoshopped the birds with afros, wearing kente cloths and graduation caps. Danielle Belton says it makes the point that black people aren't a monolith.
You could make a bird cater to you. I mean, the guy I follow on Twitter, Sean Padilla, you know, put in a request for his bird to be light-skinned with an afro playing a guitar. And, you know, she made him one.
The parody photo started showing up as Facebook profile images and Twitter pics across the internet. Baratunde Thurston says those black Twitter bird spinoffs might be even more powerful than the article itself.
That's a form of activism. That's a form of community organizing. That's a form of reasserting a claim to your own identity and countering what you see as a damaging media message.
Whoa, who knew the Twitter bird was so deep? Sam Sanders, NPR News.
This is NPR.
We have one more piece of hard scientific evidence this morning indicating climate change. We go to the northwestern coast of Sumatra in Indonesia, where scientists are reporting that the coral is dying off in one corner of the Pacific. It is one more consequence, they say, of warming oceans. NPR's Dan Charles has more.
This past spring and early summer, the Andaman Sea off the coast of Sumatra was 3, 5, even 7 degrees warmer than normal. That can be dangerous to coral, so scientists from the Wildlife Conservation Society went out to the reefs to take a look. At that time, about 60% of the coral had turned white. It was under extreme stress, but still alive. Caleb McLennan from WCS says they just went out to take a look again.
The shocking situation now is that about 80% of those that were bleached have now died.
That's just in the area McLennan's colleagues were able to survey. They're asking other scientists to check on coral in other areas of the Andaman Sea. Similar mass bleaching events have been observed this year in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Malaysia, and other parts of Indonesia. A partial die-off doesn't necessarily destroy a reef. The surviving coral can colonize dead parts of a reef and restore it. But McLennan says people and governments also play a big role. Plant-eating fish keep algae from taking over dead reefs, so restrictions on fishing can help. But in the long term, McLennan says, coral reefs need people to stop warming up Earth's climate. Dan Charles, NPR News.
In our series, My Guilty Pleasure, in which authors talk about a book or a writer they are embarrassed to love, Josh Braff remembers a cringe-inducing moment from graduate school.
In one of my very first classes in the MFA program at St. Mary's College, a mix of poets, novelists, and short story folk like me were asked to share the names of some of our favorite authors. The names Thomas Pynchon, Flannery O'Connor, and Raymond Carver flew around the room until it was my turn to introduce my literary self to my new friends. "I like John Irving," was what I said. When I looked up, the Pinchon guy was whispering and smile-giggling. Others agreed. The hush was unexpected. J. Irving was a bad answer. I remember clearing my throat and saying, "And DeLillo, of course. Joyce." This was my first lit school lesson. Keep it to yourself if Irving is for you. A guilty pleasure, if you will, like Stephen King. According to my literary colleagues, good fiction needed to be dense, like Faulkner dense. But there were two characters named Quentin, and one was a girl. That's confusing. Confusion is a part of understanding literature. It is? Oh, yes. The second lesson was the following. If you truly want to learn to write well, you'd best toss your television onto your lawn, or give the literary finger to authors who wrote big books that became films and were embraced by the mediocre masses. Oh, come on. The Dead Zone rocked. And what about The World According to Garp? You can't poo-poo Garp. For all I achieve in fiction, I thank John Irving and Stephen King. These authors are maestros of craft. Their characters live and breathe before, during, and after the story ends. I recall a relationship, a torrid love affair, with two of Irving's female characters in The Cider House Rules. I wholeheartedly embraced the notion of texture and landscape and the power of character fragility. My guess is there's an MFA student sitting in class right now, burying the fact that they've read 12 vampire novels in the last 2 years. Be truthful is my advice. Take your sunglasses off inside and tell those people who you really enjoy reading. And if they smile, giggle, and a hush comes over the room, don't do what I did and lie to your classmates. Be proud of the books you've absorbed. Revel in your guilty pleasures.
Josh Braff is the author of the recent Peep Show and The Unthinkable Thoughts of Jacob Green. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. His guilty pleasure is anything written by John Irving. And you can find more guilty pleasure essays and recommendations at the summer book section of our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered.